So often what we find is there are parts of us as a father that need validation because we've not yet been validated. We use our sons to validate who we are. And even worse, we use our sons to build our kingdoms. Friends, I hope that you've been tracking with the Become Good Soil podcast. And if you have, you will be familiar with a recent series that Sherry and I offered on the meta-narrative of feminine love. There were other names that we could have used for that series. It could have been toxic femininity. It could have been feminine love recreated. And in all of it, the intent was to explore the possibility of redeemed femininity and how essential it is to integrate with redeemed masculinity for human beings to thrive. And then we dove into a beautiful story of one of my longtime friends and allies, a like-hearted apprentice, Ryan Reibsalm. Today, we're jumping back, picking up with a start of a three-part series on the possibility of redeemed masculinity. In many ways, it's the meta-narrative of masculine love. I want to pause before we dive in and offer a few invitations. If you haven't listened to the three-part series, The Meta-Narrative of Feminine Love, go ahead and pause this podcast. You'll want to go back and you'll want to go slowly to travel the terrain of the content, you and God. And then after you immerse yourself there, come back and dive into this series on masculine love. These two series are intended to be an immersive six-part discipleship introduction on this essence of the path and process of refathering and remothering and exploring just as sort of a first deep invitation into the narrative arc of maturation as it takes place in the feminine, in the masculine. Really, another way I could say it is it's refathering and remothering the human soul. So secondly, if you're ready to dive into this series today, I want to encourage you to listen to this episode sitting down. I want you to carve out time to block out the distractions, to open your heart to receive masculine love, to receive masculine nourishment, to receive masculine affection. The first 10 minutes of this podcast, I'm going to take us into a story to wake up our hearts, a story that leads us into some of our deeper desires, perhaps, within our masculine soul, a story that helps us to recover our boyhood again. And with innocence and openness of that boy to be invited into the story we've always been searching for by one far more stronger and by one far more loving than we've ever dared to believe. Let's dive in. By way of introduction, I want to pick up with a great story from one of my favorite books, The Old Man and the Boy by Robert Rurick. And I return to this book every couple of years, and I was recently reading it again. It's essentially the story of a grandson who had the joyful privilege to spend his summers with his grandfather. And in that time, there was a substance, there was a sustenance that flowed from grandson to grandfather and from grandfather to grandson. In the reciprocity of all of it, the boy became a man. And through it, the man was blessed. And so I want to pick up with a story of one summer. It's an early spring, and the boy, who is Robert Rourke, is telling the story that we were living in a place called Wrightsville Sound that spring, a most fascinating spot to be young. It had numberless attractions for a boy, as is so with much of the coastal South. It is semi-tropic. There were vast forests of gnarled, craggy live oak trees, which were hung with Spanish moss and tall timberlands of longleaf pine. The sound itself led to two inlets on a beach 2 miles away, and the tides brought ocean fish into the sound and kept the water clean. There were little back bays that were full of fish and in the winter ducks. The woods were chattery with squirrels, little gray fellows, and big black and silver fox squirrels. There were quail in the brushy flats, and some deer, and rabbits untold. The trees were full of bright blue jays I never seem to see these days, and the little bluebirds that have also made themselves scarce. Even the vegetation was exciting to a youngster. There were whole groves of wild plum and wild asparagus shot up in the spring. There were blackberries growing by the millions. There were sparkleberries and pawpaws. There were little brown sweet nuts like chestnuts and wild artichokes. There was almost no day in the year when a boy couldn't go out on an expedition of his own and make an adventure of living off the country. A bellyache usually accompanied the experience, but at least a man felt free, free of his parents, free of the necessity of carrying a box lunch. And so in this story, you see the heart of a boy that deeply seated in the young, uninitiated boy is wildness, is longing to engage in a quest, to go out on adventure, to take risk, to become through process, through trial, through error. And in this story, you see that he's pretty untamed. He says, I was a young Tarzan. There was no house that could hold me. And so he goes on and tells story after story of adventure and being pretty uninhibited. Leads to a conversation where the old man looks at Robert and with an eyebrow cocked, he says, hey, yes, sir, I said. It's about time you calmed down a little, young feller. You remind me of a young buck Apache with no warpath to play with. I know it's spring and all colts go crazy in the spring, but you need some sort of project to quiet you down. I think I got the answer, a boat. There's something about a boat that is powerful, soothing to springtime hysterics. If you pay a little more attention to clean ears and arithmetic, I'll help you build one this month. When school's over, you can learn a whole lot of new things about fish and water this summer. You can also learn a whole lot about yourself. Ain't nothing like a boat to teach a man the worth of quiet contemplation. And so goes on the story of an old man engaging a young man to make a boat, to create a treasure together. They spent time gathering driftwood and using nails from the local store. They began to construct, to craft an invitation to adventure. The old man whittled out pins that cradled an oar like a mother holds her baby and did about half the rowing for you. They named their boat Charlotte. And he goes on to say in his reflections, if I ever get rich, I may buy me a boat of some sort, but it'll never have the adventures that Charlotte had. They were never big adventures. I looked for buried treasure on Money Island with her. I got blistered by the sun. I never found the pieces of eight. I fell out of her and stuck her on sandbars and had to swim after her now and again when she slipped her moorings. I shot out of her and caught fish out of her and got lost in her and darn near drowned alongside her. But like I said, she gave me some quiet adventure that you don't get out of your comic books because none of it was vicarious, which means, I think, getting your thrills out of what somebody else has already done better. When I was out alone in that boat, I never had to worry about amusement. I was Captain Blood looking for pirates, or I was actually on Treasure Island running for the Long John Silver. I was Zane Grey catching marlin off New Zealand, wherever that was. Or I was a section of a Spanish Armada. Or I was Hawkins or Drake. I used to take those books with me and read them while I pulled up for lunch on one of the thousands of little sandy islands. They meant a lot more than they did on the required list at Schoolhouse Library with some four-eyed schoolmarm standing over me. But mostly, I learned about how much fun a man can have amusing himself, about how exciting solitude can be if you play it right. I would get up early in the morning, row her out to one of the sandbars, jab an oar deep in the sand, and make her fast. Then I would kick around in the ooze, feeling for clams with my feet, looking for soft-shell crabs. When I had a mess of clams, I would take the cast net and prowl the shallows for mullet and shrimp for bait, casting the net in a great circular spread that drove upward sharp slivers of water as she settled, with the shrimp and the mullet bucking and arching inside the quartz. In time, I got to know, just by experimentation, where all the better holes were, where the big blackfish lived, where the weak fish hung out, where you couldn't catch anything but spiny-backed perch. Sometimes, I would take the boat around into the channel and have fun with the skipjacks, the little channel bluefish, and then I would tie her up under the channel bridge with barnacle-encrusted pilings and fish very quietly for sheephead. There were those big stone crabs, too, and to catch one of the big black and yellow fellows, whose claws were all white meat and whose body was practically non-existent, that was a big event. But the best of it was at night, when you rigged up a jacklight, took her out on low tide, let her drift gently while you looked for the shadow of flounders in the flickering yellow glow. You used a three-pong harpoon and nailed the flounder to the bottom, and he flopped mightily when you dragged him into the boat. I used to sell the flounders, if I had a good night, and made what to me was a power of money, sometimes as much as a whole dollar. Some of the best part of going out in the boat was eating the lunch I'd caught myself, pulling up to another little sandbar or Palmetto Island. I kept salt and pepper in a skillet in the locker. There was always driftwood for a fire. It occurs to me now that I was dining then off the things people pay a lot for in a restaurant. Fresh clams and oystered, broiled soft crabs, the freshest fish in the world. Perhaps it was cooked crude, but I've never eaten better since. The boy goes on to say, by the time that summer ended, I think I must have known every inch of that sound, every fish hole, every sandbar, every creek, and every cove. I knew the tricks of the tides around the inlets and the rate the water would drop, according to how the wind was blowing. It was all trial and error, cut feet, bruised fingers, mosquitoes, sandflies, and sunburn. By the end of the summer, I was considerably calmed down. Like the old man said, there's nothing like being alone on the water in a boat of your own to learn the value of peace, quiet, and responsibility. I found out you didn't need companionship to amuse yourself, that there are actually times when you can have more fun without people. A boy alone on big water is a very small thing. I didn't ever tell the old man about the time I got caught in the rip and was swept out through the inlet to sea and had to let the boat go out for a mile on the ocean before I could get loose from the tow and beat her back to the beach. I didn't tell anybody about the dead man I found. What was left of him jammed in a log wedge of marsh. He'd been in the water a long time. Didn't tell either about the rusty nail I had to cut out my foot with a pocket knife I had cauterized in a fire. I remember that very clear, sawing and hacking at the underpart of my big toe with the nail run clean up under the ball of my foot, the dull knife, and me alternately crying and cussing. Told my mother I was cut on an oyster shell when I asked her for the iodine. I guess I was afraid they would keep me out of the boat, and the marsh hen season was coming along with the big swollen tide of the September northers. When the tides cover the marsh grasses so that only the tips show, the big rails had no place to hide and would flap awkwardly up ahead of you, birds as big as woodcock with soft deer eyes. You pulled the boat then, and they flew so slow that you could leave the pole stuck in the ooze, grab a gun, and still knock down a bird. Or sometimes you moored the boat, got out of her, prowling the edge of the shoreline where the birds had come in from their flooded home in the marsh. They flushed, skittering like a snipe, headed for water, and it was fine shooting. School time came again, and weather got colder, and we hauled the boat up and put her on rollers for the winter. I went back to school, feeling a little more like a man and a little less like a boy. I reckon the old man knew what he was talking about when he said there was nothing like a boat to smooth the kinks out of a kid. This must have shown on the report card a little bit, because for Christmas that year, there was a little outward motor under the tree. The old man said he guessed I'd earned it. Friends, pause. Pause with me. Just take the story in. The old man inviting the boy to adventure, to building a boat, to set his heart on pilgrimage. Just notice what comes up for you. Notice what comes up in you as you reflect on that story. Just take a minute. Curious if some of you feel longing, some of you feel loss, some of you feel that ache of if only I was invited. Now, some of us feel the longing for another time, a simple time where a boy could adventure in the wild open without the worries and the entanglements of modern life. You know, some of us might ache for that old man. Where was he? Where is he? The man that saw me and said, come along, son, I have something for you. You know, some of us must ache for the freedom of summertime without responsibility, unchained, untamed, free to explore and wrestle and fail and learn and grow, to immerse ourselves in something and someone bigger. What comes up for you? The Old Man and the Boy by Robert Rourke is a fascinating read, and I commend it to your initiation. Because, brothers, as I've shared many times, masculine initiation was meant to be the primary interpretive grid of our days and our decades. It was meant to be the orientation from which we see. It was meant to be the narrative arc of the journey, the ascent of our soul as masculine from boy to man. And what I want to do is recover some of that narrative arc, that meta-narrative, I would name it, as the primary arc, the 30,000 feet of whatever else is going on in your story uniquely. Universally, there's an invitation to respond to God, to recover the quest, to be located by the heart of God, to tune in to that particular version of the universal invitation to initiation. You know, Jesus shares a secret with us in his last night with his closest friends. He says, knowing that Jesus came from the Father and was returning to the Father, he began to act. He began to act out the image of his Father, the heart of his Father, by serving those entrusted to his care, by coming under them, by asking, how can I bless you? How can I strengthen you? You see, we come from the Trinity and we return to the Trinity. This is our orientation, and this is why the ache. As you recall, when Lewis says, if we have an ache and a longing for a thing that cannot be satisfied in this world, it must be the evidence that we are made for a world beyond this world. You see, there is a world beyond this world. There is a God that existed before us. He is perfectly safe. He's perfectly okay. He has more than enough. He is at ease, and he has a plan to restore our hearts as men. You see, he is the headwaters of everything we see in this world expressed as gender. As we shared in the last episodes, in the beginning, God created us from his very being. Male and female, he created us. There's something he meant through masculinity that he did not mean through femininity. And there's something that he meant through femininity that he does not mean through masculinity. And there's something in the depth and the mystery of his heart that the coming together of two being made one says something to the world, enacts some power, some goodness, some love, some restorative movement together to bring everything on earth as it is in the heavens. That is to say, everything as it was intended to be. And that's why we hear this theme in Jesus's life, is that the goal is to mature. The goal is to mature in a specific way, to mature in oneness with the heart of God, to become, very simply, a wholehearted, integrated, mature man. The kind of person whose identity is so deeply rooted in the truth that he can be well, he can be filled with joy, he can be at ease with himself in any circumstances. That's what we're chasing after. How do we recover that? How do we find the story, the narrative arc of masculine love in order that we can know where we are on that path, to know where we've come, to know where from which we have come, and to know where we are going? I want to explore some of those themes in these upcoming podcasts. I want to give you questions to consider, big ideas to return to, stories to reflect on, and above all, an invitation to receive more nourishment from the heart of God, more tracks of your initiation recovered, where you can say, wherever I am, whatever I have, I can make it through in the one who makes me who I am. And so, friends, let's start at a beginning. I love in Proverbs where Solomon, known as the wisest man, paints a picture, a manual for living. He says, I'm going to give you a guidebook of sorts for your initiation as a man. And in it, in Proverbs 1, he says this. I love coming right out of the gates. Solomon says, it starts with God. The first step in learning is bowing down to God. Only a fool thumbs their nose at such wisdom and learning. Friends, life is full. Life is busy. Life can be profoundly complex. I want you to take heart today to be reminded that the invitation from God is to start with God. That is to say, to not start with you, not start with your circumstances, not even start with your need, but it's to start with God. God, let me see your face. Show me what you're like. remind me who you are. Remind me of the story in which we find ourselves. Help me start here. It goes on in Proverbs 2 to say, good friends, take heart. Collect my counsels and guard them with your life. And friends, that's my hope, that together on this quest of becoming wholehearted kings, that we together can collect counsel, guidelines, and guardrails that help us immerse ourselves in that which is true and good and beautiful, and guard them with our life. This is echoed in the book of Colossians, where it says, be assured from the first day that we heard of you, we haven't stopped praying for you, asking God to give you wise minds and spirits attuned to his will, and so acquire a thorough understanding of the way God works. Friends, God is at work, and he is working to give us wise minds, to give us spirits that are increasingly attuned to his heart, to his character, and to the way in which he works. And the invitation is that we would live well, not independently, but for God. The imagery is one of a garden or an orchard that we tend to, that we invest in, that we work and play and toil and succeed and fail as we learn how God works. Paul says, I pray that you would have the strength to stick it out over the long haul, not a grim strength of gritting your teeth, but a glory strength that comes from God, a strength that endures the unendurable and spills over into joy, thanking the Father who makes us strong enough to take part in everything bright and beautiful that he has for us. Brothers, there is something bright and something beautiful that the Father has for you here and now. He is offering you his strength. This is not just gut it out. This is, will you let me in to be your strength? And in order that you as my son can have a strength that endures the unendurable, having confidence that it will spill out in increasing joy and increasing gratitude. See, friends, we are the sons of God, and that identity is forever being challenged in our life. It's being accused. It's being stolen. It's being surrendered. In so many ways, it's even being mocked. If you are the Son of Man, how often I feel just that temptation of the world, of the evil, to just mock me in my foolishness to trust that I am a son, my foolishness to trust that I'm safe, my foolishness to trust that I'm okay, that God will prevail in my marriage, with my kids, my vocation, my stewardship of what's been entrusted to my care. But friends, we have to start with this identity. We are the sons of God. And so how do we become the sons of God? See, you cannot be a man until you've been a son. And the problem, the predicament, is we find ourselves in a man's world. And yet there are parts of us that have yet to become a son. And what I want to assure you of today, the words from Ephesians are true, that it is God's pleasure and his will to invite us back to return as his sons. The one who knows you best is the one who loves you most. And so what would it look like to allow the young places in you today to risk confidently that it is God's joy and it is God's intention to bring you home? You see, the Father brings us something very different than mother. as we talked about in the last series, mom is rooted in something utterly fundamental, something like self-worth. You are loved because you exist. It's blessedness of being. And from that fundamental wellness, that fundamental nourishment, food, encouragement, safety, touch, gaze, delight, affection, there's another force at work that builds upon that foundation. And it's the life of the Father, love as validation. Whatever else is happening in your story, the Father is fighting relentlessly to recover and to repair the truth that you are loved, that you have what it takes. He's giving you everything you need to be well. And so there are stages of masculine initiation, and there's so many places we've touched on this, you know, the body of work, it become good soil, becoming a king walks through this. John's done beautiful work and teaching on this of fathered by God, many other sources, and there are details for another time. But in general, for this podcast, I want to visit this narrative arc, this meta-narrative of masculine initiation and masculine love. And that arc is simply the heart of a man moving, transitioning from infant to boyhood to young adulthood to mature adult. If there's anything else going on, or I should say, whatever else is going on in our story, what is also true is the Father is working and willing so that every part in us from infant moves into boyhood, into young adult, into mature adult, with the idea of every part of us eventually coming home to God, maturing in oneness, being united with God, wholehearted, and released to be fully alive. And so what happens, what's intended, what gets in the way, how can we heal and repair those places within us and consequently bring healing and repairing to relationships entrusted to our care, where our brokenness or our lack of maturity or initiation has gotten in the way. Let's start with the boy. What I want to do for a moment is to visit boyhood, this idea that the boy needs a father. So what I want to do is go through the stages a bit and just look at what goes wrong and how can we recover the path. See, the boy needs a father. He needs a father that does for him what the old man did for the boy in Robert Rourke's story. He needs a father that is whole enough and well enough in his being. He's become the kind of man he wants his son to become. But the problem is when you have an uninitiated man initiating a boy, you get deep conflict. And what's meant to be love as validation, what comes in its place is accusation or rejection or disapproval or envy. So often what we find is there are parts of us as a father that need validation because we've not yet been validated. We use our sons to validate who we are. And even worse, we use our sons to build our kingdoms. And men, you know this, just you can try it on and feel it, not only in your story, but just start with the headlines, start with the news, start with observing what we would say are adult men. So often you see the older man, at least a man in a man's role, and yet what's manifesting is a boy. What's manifesting is part of him that lacks initiation, that's desperate to have his question answered, and he will stop at nothing to feel like a man. And so often, the older man will use the boy. And so much of this is subconscious. You'll see a jealousy that surfaces between the man and the boy. And so much of that jealousy can be rooted in shame and fear that is below the surface because the boy is pushing against places in the man that say, I don't have what it takes. Often there'll be a unhealthy competition, or there'll be distancing of the heart of the father away from the son, rooted in shame or rooted in fear of just not knowing what to do. So often when the boy triggers something in the man, what it's intended to do is to alert the man to say, oh, this needs tended to. This needs care. But instead, what happens is the man's initiation gets enmeshed and entangled with the son's initiation. I know that can sound complex, but let me simplify for a moment. God is always initiating his sons. He's initiating the man, he's initiating the boy, and oftentimes those initiations can be complementary. I'm going through a season where I've been initiated much as a hunter, as an archery hunter, and my son is being initiated as an archery hunter, and we can go out together and together have amazing initiation experiences. And yet, when there are places in the father that aren't yet initiated, often when he's trying to father a son through the son's initiation, those things can come in conflict. I can think of a story of a father who was new at hunting, and he was taking his son out to hunt, and they both had a tag. They both had a license for an elk. And an elk presented itself, and something in the father just took over, and he pushed the son out of the way and actually took a shot. And then he missed and he took another shot. And he missed and took another shot. And the son was just a little bit thrown off of like, what's going on? And the father didn't know. It wasn't malicious. He didn't know what he was doing. But in that moment, what took over was an uninitiated part of the boy inside the man. And it came at the expense of his son. And brothers, this is so important to tune into. And that's why there's no shortcut to fathering. That's why it's a dilemma when I am asked again and again and again of how do I initiate my sons? It's a genuine question. It's a holy question. But most of the time, it's rooted in pressure. And below that pressure is often shame or fear, or a sort of anxiety of, I don't have what it takes. And below that is a question that's subterranean that goes something like, how do I offer what I don't have? And so let me give just a very practical example. We are on the eve, literally, I leave tomorrow, the eve of the biggest hunt of my son's life. In Colorado, you earn one preference point per year, every year that you put in the lottery for a hunting tag or a hunting license for a particular species. It begins at age 12 when you go through your hunter safety and acquire your ability to get a big game license. And so from 12 to 19, my son acquired a point per year. stacked up 7 points. And consequently, in those years, he could never come with me archery, elk hunting, because he always had football. And football competed enough that I could slip Joshua away for a 2-day hunt, maybe even a 3-day hunt for antelope or for deer, and put him in the truck after a Friday night football game and drive him somewhere, hunt out of a tree stand or a blind or a short hunt in wild places, and then quickly back to school on Monday. But Joshua is in a unique gap year. He has consented to this initiation quest of 18 months between high school and before heading to Colorado Christian University. He has an 18-month quest where he is learning about life and working and serving and doing missions and spending time with older men. And he's just consenting to his initiation. And so I have him for the month of September. He put in for a very rare elk tag in Colorado. He had a 36% chance of drawing that tag. And he got it for this month. And so for the better part of the month of September, he'll be heading out. And my dream was to guide him and call in a screaming bull elk for him to put an arrow in and have the full experience start to finish of backcountry, do-it-yourself, public land, bow hunting, where his father called in a bull elk and Joshua got to arrow it. That was my dream. And I've spent a lot of time in the backcountry every chance I've gotten this summer scouting this new unit. It was brand new to us. And it was intimidating and overwhelming at times of learning new country and trying to figure it out from square one. How do we find elk? How do we work competitively with other hunters so that we can have a unique opportunity over time to get Joshua close to a rutting bull? And what I realized, friends, was there was a fallacy. There was a danger that by God's grace, he alerted me to. You see, I've guided quite a bit and I've learned a lot about hunting, but I have yet to call in a bull successfully in an archery hunt for someone else to harvest. I've called in a lot of bulls in different situations, playing with them. I've called in a bull. I called in a bull for Sam Eldridge on a rifle hunt, which was a super awesome experience. But I've never called in a bull in an archery environment where someone successfully arrowed that elk. And it's been a dream of mine, and it's the next place in my initiation. And God, over many hours of prayer at different times, he showed me that this hunt isn't primarily for me. It's primarily for Joshua. It's primarily for him to immerse himself in wildness. It's primarily for him to have the time to watch the rut unfold over weeks. It's primarily for him to have multiple encounters, and primarily for him to have the opportunity to arrow a bull. And so in that, I could see a resistance for getting help. I have a hunting partner and a few great friends that I've hunted with, even a friend who is a guide in Colorado in that unit, all of which have offered help. And I was reluctant, I was resistant. And friends, as I listened to my heart, I realized part of my reluctance was the contamination, let me say, of my initiation and my son's initiation. So I had to pause and back up and ask, God, what is this about? What is my motive? And I had to have the courageous separation to ask, what if this were just about Joshua? What if this were just about responding to what God's invitation is for my son and for his initiation? And so with that, I courageously, reluctantly let go of the pressure of me needing to call in a bull for Joshua. Now, it still may happen. I'm going to have a lot of days with him in the field, and we have no idea how it will unfold. But what I do know is this: my initiation is not Joshua's initiation. and I cannot invite him somewhere where I have not been. And so I turned a corner and I looked at the month and I realized that there are multiple commitments that I need to be in town. And so I laid out an entire schedule consenting to invitations from older, more experienced men and said, absolutely, I receive your guidance. I receive your counsel. I receive your willingness to help my son. And it very well may be that Joshua has an encounter with a bull, not only that I don't call in for him, but also that I may not even be there when it happens. But friends, that's the distinction, to not allow my initiation to be enmeshed in my son's initiation. And so friends, one more detail that just helps sort of unpack this idea. The very first time I went out to scout the unit, I felt really intimidated. I felt unfathered. And I found myself driving on a couple Jeep roads that were not big enough for my Ford F-150. I'd been up two of the running boards and I was just really beating myself up for what an idiot I felt like for trying to drive on these roads by myself that my truck couldn't fit. And I got an injury riding a bike to try to scout by bike after that. I felt like I went down some different drainages that were totally unsuccessful. And it began with scarcity, overwhelmed, intimidation, and over 3 days, my heart settled in. I brought the young places to God. I invited God's fathering. I let go of pressure. And then I realized the things I was learning. I was learning how to better read the digital maps I was working off, to understand the terrain of the unit, to know where I can navigate, where I can't, where I need to get on a bike and park my truck to scout out roads that I may or may not be able to travel. And over those 3 days, I began to have a sense of the unit, of a strategy, of a possibility. I returned a couple other times just with God and asked a bunch of questions to other people that had some familiarity with the unit. It was only then, after those solo scouts, that Joshua accompanied me on a scouting trip. And what was so cool was I was able to take him to places I had already gone. I was able to laugh with him about how I banged up my truck and the stupid stuff I did and where I failed. And there was a settledness in his heart that my initiation didn't have to come at his expense. And so friends, it's nuanced. It's not to say that God is not initiating us alongside of our sons, but it is to say we have to be on guard at not having our initiation get tangled and enmeshed in our son's initiation. And so I want to pause there for episode one, and I want you to stay with that idea of the danger of the uninitiated father. What happens when there is something in me that needs initiation? Something in me that's unresolved? Something in me that's immature? And I find myself at the helm of coaching a team, at the helm of leading a committee, at the helm of managing people, at the helm of stewarding a household or an event or a mission, at the helm of initiating my son or my daughter. Can you notice that thing that rises up when it feels like you're failing? When it feels like perhaps you're being rejected by the ones who you are trying to love, when you feel simply misunderstood by them? Have you noticed envy or jealousy that rises up when you watch what your son or a younger person has entrusted to your care? Do you notice yourself making distance, intentionally or unintentionally, from a younger man? And do you notice why you might be doing so? Or do you notice this energy to be a big deal, prove yourself, show your accolades, focus on your past your achievements, while all the while something in you might just be looking to be noticed, to be loved. You see, brothers, the boy needs an invitation to adventure, just as Robert Rourke needed the invitation from an older man to build a boat and set out on a quest. But we cannot offer what we haven't received. And so as we wrap this first episode on recovering the meta-narrative of masculine love, recovering a path and process of initiation, I want to invite you to pause and just notice what's coming up at the frontier of your soul as a man. What part of you feels frustrated, embarrassed, ill-equipped? Or what part of you simply does not feel at ease? Maybe a way to say it is, where do you find a dilemma within your soul that's rising up? Brothers, it starts with God. You're in good hands. This is right on time. And so with that hope and risking that confidence, let's lean into the words from Ephesians, where Paul says, my response is to get down on my knees before my Father, in whom I am at his mercy. This Father who is parceling out heaven and earth, this Father who names me, this Father who's entrusting things to my care because he has confidence in me. And even more than confidence, he has delight. And so I ask my Father to strengthen me by his Spirit. Father, I ask that it wouldn't be a brute strength, but it would be a glorious inner strength, that Christ would live in me more deeply as I open the gates of my masculine soul, inviting him in to uninitiated places. Brothers, whatever you felt, whatever you're feeling from these ideas, the invitation is to open the door of that feeling and invite Christ in. Jesus, would you come into this place of exposure, this place of unmet need? And I ask, Christ, that with both feet planted firmly on love, that I would be able to take in with my fellow like-hearted kings this extravagant, utterly personal, unique dimension of Christ's love manifesting the Father heart of God, that I would reach out and experience breadth, test the lengths, plumb the depths, rise to heights, the full life of my heart being initiated, restored, protected, and provided for as a man. I want to enter the fullness of God right in these circumstances, right in this moment. God can do anything, far more than we could ever imagine or guess or request in our wildest dreams. And brothers, he is not the one who pushes us around. He works within us, his Spirit, deeply and gently within us. He's inviting us to grow up, to mature, to face the impossible, to endure the unendurable, to come to a reckoning with that thing that feels impossible. Impossible to face, impossible to take up, impossible to put down. Friends, this is where it gets real. This is where we gain the raw and beautiful miles of masculine transformation, where we become whole. We become at ease. We become mature. We move forward in our process so that we can turn to that person which is behind us, the younger man, and say, come with me. You're in good hands. Brothers, this is just part one, and I want to linger here. 90 seconds. Stay with this prayer. Stay with these questions. Stay with your Father. He is perfectly safe. You are perfectly on time. And there's something for you in this moment. Enjoy yourself. Enjoy God. 90 seconds. And we'll be back for part two.